Welcome back to Schneps Connects. Today's guest is Ronald Richter, who brings more than 35 years of experience in child welfare, law, and public service to the conversation. From serving as a legal aid attorney, family court judge, and commissioner of New York City's Administration for Children's Services, to now leading JCCA, which is one of New York's oldest and most impactful child and family services organizations. Ron has seen the system from every angle. As CEO of JCCA, Ron oversees programs that touch the lives of more than 17,000 children and families every year, ranging from foster and residential care to mental health, education, prevention, and family support. His leadership has driven reforms that prioritize keeping families together, advancing race equity, expanding community-based services, and ensuring children have the opportunity to thrive. Today, Ron will share his insights on what's working in child welfare, where challenges remain, and how we can move toward a more equitable and effective system for children and families. So thanks so much, Ron. I appreciate your time and look forward to this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So I know I touched on your background, which is quite extensive. I'd love for you to just give a little, you know, background on your career and really how you got into this line of work.
So I think I got into this work because there's so much that we can do as a society to support children. And I come from a family where both my mother and my father lost their fathers very young, so single mothers, and both had really, in some ways, traumatic childhoods. My mother's mother was mentally challenged. And when I say that, I mean depression, anxiety, and a single mom. Mm. And my dad's childhood was fraught from 1939 to 1945 by the Holocaust. He spent those years, he was between the ages of 11 and 15, 16, being hidden in France and experiencing some circumstances that never left him. And sure. He lived till 95, but so long story long, that's, I think, why ultimately I came into this work. I didn't really understand the father part until I was a family court judge removing children. There had been a separation from my father when he was 11 from his mother after losing his dad. And it was because they couldn't escape Belgium together. So he and his sibling were separated from their mother.
Well, listen, that's certainly a good reason for you to get into the line of work that you're doing now. How do you think those experiences shaped your approach of what you do in the role as CEO of JCCA?
I think it's about making sure people understand every single child is different, whether they're in the same family, and every parent is different. And we don't know when we meet a client, other than it's probably in many cases not a great experience for them if they're meeting us, for example, through a foster care placement. It's really important to me that we listen to what our clients say and appreciate that they've been in a better place at some point in their life, and it's our job to figure out how to support them to get back there. And so leading this organization, which, as you pointed out, serves thousands of children and families a year, it's really important that our staff appreciate that every single child is different.
Yeah.
And I always say to them, you know, do you have a brother or a sister? And would you describe yourself as being the same as them? And the answer is usually no.
Always. It's got almost always. 90,
yeah.
And I bet.
So that really has to influence how we approach the work.
That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, for sure. So we heard a little bit about your history. Let's hear the history of JCCA and, you know, really what its services are.
So JCCA was founded in 1822.
Wow.
There were Jews that came to the United States in the 1600s. By the early 1800s, they wanted to pool their resources in order to provide cash transfers to immigrant Jews who were really struggling in the 1820s in New York. Very soon after that, three decades later, the waves of immigration, including Jewish people, were becoming overwhelming for the city of New York, and they sought support from charities, in particular They were interested in what should happen to children who were being, infants usually, being removed from their mothers by the police and put in the hospital because they were struggling and their mothers didn't have work, didn't have a place to live. And so those children, sometimes called single parent orphans, ended up being the focus of JCCA in the mid 1800s. And we're an organization that built orphanages, big orphanages in Brooklyn and Manhattan to care for thousands of children that were situated in this way. By the late 1800s, we were able to start providing services to mostly mothers at home with their kids, thanks to widows' pensions. By the early 1900s, we developed a foster care program with middle-class Jews in Queens and the Bronx. And we pretty much have been doing the same thing since then. In 1911, we were bequeathed a large piece of land in Westchester County that we turned into a cottage school and brought kids up from the city so that they were in a more bucolic setting. So we really have been providing, and I think with innovation, sort of support for families struggling with mental health challenges, with child safety issues, with education deficits. We've been serving these young people in really the same way since the mid-1800s and are really proud that in many cases, we've been on the cutting edge of developing particularly services for families that are at risk of a child being removed, what we call preventive services. We've invested in a lot of work around what are called evidence-based models. So approaches to the social work that have been demonstrated to actually reduce the risk of harm to children at home.
Well, I want to stay on that topic of mental health around kids. You know, I hear it's rising and you know, I look at technology and how that plays in terms of, you know, children being on devices at every second and being exposed to all different types of things. How is JCCA addressing those mental health needs of children specifically?
Yeah, Josh, I want to add to what you said. I think that for our current generation, there was a pandemic that made it very difficult for parents to regulate how much time kids were spending on social media because it was their only outlet. They were essentially sequestered at home. Yep. And so it was a really challenging situation. And what it resulted in, what you're referencing, is a major increase in anxiety and depression among young people. I think that social media has certainly been part of the problem. And, you know, the question is, can it also be part of the solution? And I think we are at the, you know, very initial stages of figuring that out. JCCA is determined to make behavioral health services available in communities. So in answering your question, we celebrated our 200th birthday in 2022. And our goal for our third century is really about becoming premier provider of community-based preventive behavioral health. So how do we find children and families who have experienced one adverse childhood experience so that they don't experience another one? And I'm referencing the ACES study, which is a ACES study, which anyone can go online and take the ACES study. And generally speaking, the data, which was accumulated and done by Kaiser Permanente, shows that if you have significant number of adverse childhood experiences before you're 18, it will result in you having a greater likelihood of certain physical ailments, heart disease, cancer, asthma, diabetes, and there's a correlation. So if before you turn 18, a parent dies, you are exposed to domestic violence, you have relatives who's close to you, who's been killed, it has an impact on your future. So our hope is to prevent children who, for example, have been exposed to domestic violence once from accumulating more of those experiences. And the way to do that is to make behavioral health services available in the communities where families that are at risk of this, and many are, how we integrate ourselves there and really continue to sort of raise awareness about how important it is to be well. And that also means being well emotionally.
So talk specifically about some of those services that you offer. What are they?
So they're very often, especially for adolescents, they're group therapy. Often it's not even the therapist that matters as much as young people knowing that there are other young people who are experiencing the same issues. And amazingly, to complement social media or complement the virtues of Zoom, kids can Zoom into sessions with a group, and we are able to provide those sessions. And that's really great for teenagers because they really don't like to be identified as needing to go to any kind of therapy at all because they're teenagers.
Of course.
We also provide respite services. So a family that's really struggling with a kid that has high-end mental health needs that is sometimes disruptive for a family, they can get a break. Another example would be what we call care management. So a family that has a child that has a significant diagnosis or two would be able to have someone support them, the kid, and the family by routine check-ins, visits, ensuring that prescriptions are filled, ensuring that appointments are kept, sort of really helping support the parent's executive function and, offering other potential services as the relationship develops. So those are a few ways in which we are trying to provide what I described.
How do you balance the needs of the children versus having that supportive family environment? I assume that sometimes they don't always work together.
That's true. I would say that in majority of situations that it is very possible and encouraged to ensure that children are not removed from their families. It is the exceptional cases where there has to be a removal. And I think you're pointing, Josh, to an issue that is the subject of a great deal of controversy, and maybe it always has been, which is the pendulum in child welfare between really supporting families so that they can stay together safely and removing a child because you simply can't get the family to a point where government thinks the child is safe. And unfortunately, in child welfare, it's the cases where there's been an oversight or a failure to take action with respect to a particular child at risk that really draws the most attention. But on the ground, it is a day-to-day struggle with almost everyone believing strongly that we do not want to remove children. That means if you remove a child, you have to return a child. And we're not very good at figuring out how to do that expeditiously. We've certainly improved tremendously, but I would say that you're asking a question about the pendulum, and most of us spend most of our time supporting children at home. There are going to be cases where there need to be removals. But in 1990, there were about 50,000 kids that were in foster care from the city of New York. And today, we think there
See that number again?
50,000 children.
Wow.
And today, that number is closer to 7,000. So there's been a determined public policy to reduce removals and reduce the use of out-of-home care. And the way we've done that is by meeting families where they are and trying really hard to connect with them and offer them services that are going to help the parent develop more control sometimes, more empathy sometimes, more capacity. And that can also mean concrete things, money to pay the rent, food, et cetera. So, it's a complicated area to work in. And I do think that people too hastily rush to judgment about what we're doing wrong without fully appreciating what we're doing that really supports families and communities.
Well, listen, it's got to be very difficult to get out into the community and connect with people. First of all,
Yeah.
people have to be willing to acknowledge there's a problem, which is very difficult for people, not just, do it individually, but have to say that their parents are being abusive or any other things like that. It must be extremely difficult. And then I'm sure being out in the community, is also expensive to staff and execute.
And post-pandemic, folks really want to have options to work remotely. And this is a classic human service
Sure.
where you really can't support people without developing a face-to-face relationship that is three-dimensional. That is how human services work. So if you talk to anybody who does what I do across the country, you would hear that we are in a workforce crisis because we are competing with CVS.com and others that can hire licensed clinicians who can be at home for the day, switching in and out of taking care of their kids and working. And in our line of work, that is more challenging than your standard, weekly therapy.
Where do you see the area in which child welfare can be improved?
Oh my gosh, there are so many ways. I think that in New York, we really struggle with the fact that if there are 60,000 calls to the New York State Central Registry of Abuse or Neglect, which is how you report an allegation that, you think your patient is being hurt, you think your neighbor's being hurt, we investigate all 60,000 because the law requires. So if the state accepts the call, we're going to investigate. About 25 to 30% of those investigations end up netting a finding that there is something wrong. And what that means is that we are spending a lot of dollars, right? So 70 to 75% of the investigations, which are quite expensive, right? Staff are out there in the community seeing kids, making assessments. We're spending a lot of resources on calls that should never be referred to a jurisdiction. And meaning, if a call goes into Albany, New York City is investigating a lot of families that are traumatized by the investigation and net nothing. So I think a big challenge for us, and this is maybe controversial, is that we should be leveraging big data and artificial intelligence to do better. No one is suggesting it should ever replace human beings, but supporting those human beings with data, what we call predictive modeling or predictive analytics, could make a big difference. It's very controversial. And some of that is driven by the fact that the data we have is considered biased. It's considered absolute disproportionate representation of people of color in child protection investigations. In some states, it's indigenous people that are disproportionately overrepresented. That's a challenge that we need to figure out, which I believe increasingly we have the science to figure that out. So I think there's a lot of room for the front door of child welfare to really be modernized. And I think it'll happen. I just think it's going to take some time.
Listen, people didn't want to use computers either, but now you can't live without them.
There you go.
So, listen, getting through 60,000, I'm sure there's a lot of downside to that time that's hurting families that really need the help.
Oh my gosh, exactly.
Sure, there's
That's the
no
argument,
perfect
right?
solution, but
The argument is that if you had a better quality screening, that you would then only be investigating cases where there's a greater likelihood of something being wrong.
how much of your role is advocacy? Like, what's your focus as CEO in terms of advocacy on behalf of JCCA or just the industry as a whole?
I spend a lot of time on it. I think part of it is because I really like it. And I really think there ought to be a lot more attention paid to solutions for children who are struggling and their families. And children don't vote, which, that's not going to change so far as I can tell. But they need very compelling, vocal advocates who go to Albany, go to Washington, go to the city hall, and explain as well as possible the importance of healthy adolescence, healthy childhood, right? We know so much about 0 to 5, and we're learning so much more about adolescence as key periods in the human brain's development. If we're not investing in the kinds of supports for communities and kids that really shore up everything that's possible, we're in big trouble. And it's not a pretty statistic, but we should all be shocked and appalled that in New York City, a third of school children are chronically absent. A third of our students Wow. are missing 10% or more of school a year. What's going on, right? Like, you have to ask yourself, are their families struggling? Are they fearful that their kid is going to get sick if they go to school? But we need practical solutions that are community-based to address this. To me, it's unfathomable, right? If where I was growing
up... Yeah, it's breathtaking. It's scary.
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up in the 70s, if a third of my classroom was empty, you know, it's noticeable and it's meaningful. And obviously that's a dramatization, but this is a critical issue for us to address. And so I, to answer your question, think that I have, you know, relatively good experience up close and personal with families in various roles. And I think people are open to listening to the kinds of arguments I'm making to you and then investing in programs that are really about preventing further harm later on in life. The, you know, a stark story, Josh, is that the guy who perpetrated the Topps murder in Buffalo, New York, a couple of few years ago, was 18 years old and had a documented history of behavioral health issues that were not treated. Mm. 18. And so when we look at crime on the subway and other sorts of areas, we have to ask ourselves, how do we prevent that with some investments? And I think advocating for that is critically important.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, you talked about a lot of things in terms of numbers. I mean, the 50,000, even if it's 7,000 or whatever, that's breathtaking. The number of children that aren't going to school. You know, I think every child you support must be a success. But how are you looking at parameters, or what are you looking at to define success and, you know, being able to make an impact that's substantial?
I think that the amount of time it takes us to engage a family is a very key metric, because it takes time to develop trust. And so figuring out how to improve engagement so that families are more likely to trust us matters. And especially through the pandemic, learned that if families feel like you're looking out for their basic needs, can they pay the rent? Can they buy food? Can they get medicine? They tend to take your efforts to sort of support parental executive function. It makes it more likely that they're willing to hear you. So that's very important, engagement and how successful we are. I also think the amount of time that we work with a family is an important metric. So, you know, if we're working with a family and 3 years later, things haven't changed, that's not so good. So once the engagement is, you know, established and some trust is established, how long does it take us to address the reasons why a family came to us in the first place? So how long does it take to achieve the outcomes that the family and our team have together sort of charted out? Very important. Obviously, I think that you want to see kids that are in out-of-home care go home relatively quickly. You know, and if not, you don't want, you know, maybe there needs to be an alternative plan. But those are a few of the areas that I think we try to look at to sort of ask ourselves, are we having an impact?
So you talked about the organization being around now. It's going into 300 plus years. Is that right?
This year, we're 203 years old. We're one of the oldest.
200 years.
Yeah.
So what do you say is next? I mean, what does the evolution look like? And I'd love for you to share how the public can be involved in supporting the organization.
So jccany.org is our website, and there are opportunities to volunteer and there are opportunities to support us. I think our third century is all about what I talked about before, which is how do we work with the state to ensure that we can afford to provide quality preventive behavioral health where kids and families are. That could be, I was a family court judge, in many cases that are related to custody and family violence, parents want access to services, and we need to integrate ourselves where they are. Same thing with domestic violence shelters. We should be able to be there to catch families that want our supports. And while I think New York State has made some important progress, we have to keep pushing to make it affordable to provide these services. And obviously, we are all stressed out about Medicaid cuts, and they're looming, and we don't want those cuts to affect children. And I know that sounds ridiculous because it's going to affect everyone, including children, but we really are strenuously advocating for kids to be really carefully considered as the state figures out what to do. It could be billions and billions of dollars of lost federal funding.
You know, Ron, last question for you, which I don't think I addressed earlier, is you were talking about serving the city and having a campus in Westchester, but do you serve children from throughout the state and families, or is your focus on the metro area?
So when it comes to our preventive services and so behavioral health services for communities, we are in the five boroughs.
Okay.
When it comes to residential care, because JCCA has a very unique array of services for kids at the highest end, kids that have very significant intellectual developmental disabilities coupled with a serious emotional disturbance, usually trauma. They have had traumatic lives and they're 14, 15. So because we actually offer fairly sophisticated, unusual services, we serve the whole state of New York on our Westchester campus. So we have kids from everywhere. We also provide behavioral health services in Westchester through what's called a day treatment program. So we're the ancillary services at a school that's specialized so that those kids and families get the behavioral health services they need.
Well, Ron, you're doing God's work. It's not easy. And you know what? These children, when you think about the number of children not even going to school on a daily basis and what impact that must have on their mental state, it's kind of breathtaking. So, you know, the need is certainly there, and I'm glad that JCCA is a part of that.
Thank you so much for your time.
Again, yeah, likewise. It's been a pleasure to learn more about you. Yeah.
JCCANY.org.
All right. So two things for our listeners. Check out his website and subscribe to the Schneps Connects podcast. You know, if you're listening, you can get us at podcast.schnepsmedia.com or on any podcast network.